Okay, we can start. Today is July 20th, 2013. Okay, we start with the homage to the Buddha. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Okay, good morning, everybody. Okay, so we've been studying Sutta number 101 in the Middle Length Discourses. This is the discourse at Devadatta. And last week we took the first part of this discourse in which the Buddha is engaging in a kind of discussion or a debate with the Jains. Some of the Jain ascetics. And according to the Jain teaching, sort of the underlying foundation of their practice is the idea that in order to be completely liberated, they have to eradicate all of the karma that has been stored up through the beginningless past. Because whatever, they say, whatever a person experiences, all whether it's painful or pleasant, all that is the result of karma that was done in the past. And so to be liberated, what they try to do is to accelerate the process of exhausting the karma by subjecting themselves to physical austerities, to practices of self-mortification. And so this is quite different from the Buddha's practice. And so the Buddha first approaches the Jains and then he asks them whether they know that they've experienced so much, that they've undergone so much karma in the past, whether they existed in the past or did not exist, whether they did evil actions in the past, whether by practicing these austerities they're going to exhaust their suffering, and so on and so forth. And to all of these questions, the Jains answer no, that they don't have that knowledge themselves. Okay, so then in paragraph 9 of the sutta, on page 829, the Buddha says, but since, O friend Nikantas, you do not know that you existed in the past, and so forth, it is not fitting for the Venerable Nikantas to declare, to make all of these declarations that whatever a person experiences is due to what was done in the past, that when they undergo these austerities, all suffering will be exhausted. So that's where we finished up last time. And so now the text continues. When this was said, then the Nikantas told the Buddha, they said, friend, the Nikanta Nataputta is omniscient and all-seeing, and he claims to have complete knowledge and vision, thus, whether I'm walking or standing or asleep or awake, knowledge and vision are continuously and uninterruptedly present to me. So according to the Buddhist text, this is a claim that the teacher of the Jains, Mahavira, made about himself, to have omniscience on all occasions, under all circumstances, even when he's asleep. He knows everything. Okay, and then the Jains continue. And he says, he has said to us, Nikantas, you have done evil actions in the past, exhaust them by performing these piercing austerities. And when you are here and now restrained in body, speech, and mind, then you will not be creating any evil karma for the future. And thus, by annihilating with the ascetic practices, the austerities, past karma, and by creating no fresh karma, then there will be no consequence in the future, no flowing out of that karma into the form of a new existence. And when there is no consequence in the future, then all suffering will be exhausted. So this is what the Jain teacher Mahavira, Nigantha Nataputta, teaches the Jains. And now the Jains say to the Buddha that we approve of this and we accept this, and so we are satisfied. Okay, they don't know this themselves, they don't see this themselves, but they accept this out of trust in their teacher Mahavira, because they have trust that Mahavira is omniscient, and so he teaches this on the basis of his omniscience. Okay, now, we Buddhas say, we say that we have defilements. Because of the defilements, we create karma. And through the maturing of this karma, we experience pleasure and pain, and sometimes fortune, misfortune, in this present life, and we'll experience it in future lives. You know, just look at the account of the Buddha's enlightenment. We looked at it last week. The Buddha says that with the divine eye, which is purified, surpasses the human, I saw beings passing away and taking rebirth. Those who did bad deeds of body, speech, and mind are reborn in bad destinations. They meet with misfortune, they undergo suffering, and so on. Whereas those who have done good deeds by body, speech, and mind are reborn in happy states. They meet with good fortune and they experience good circumstances and pleasant experiences. And so if somebody asks, well, we're Buddhists, what is the basis for believing that? Or what is the basis for accepting that? What do you say? Johnny?
Faith.
Faith in what?
To be verified.
What?
Faith to be verified.
How are you going to verify it?
Coming to the class?
No.
Reflection?
The Jains can say, we reflect on this, it seems reasonable to us. Sagara Kanti, how about you? You can't convince someone that
you did or did not.
Did or didn't experience it. But how about our belief that we have done karma in the past and we're meeting the results of it in the present? On what basis do we accept? See you.
About the past?
Yeah. Okay. Okay, that's good. Yeah.
What about the present?
But faith in what?
Faith in the Buddha.
Okay.
Exactly the same words.
Okay, so we have faith in the Buddha too. We accept this on faith in the Buddha. The Buddha, at least in the suttas, he doesn't claim to be omniscient, all knowledge, to have all knowledge present all the time, sleeping and waking, but he certainly declares certain things on the basis of abhinya, super knowledge. And we accept them out of trust in the Buddha. So accepting out of trust isn't faulty. Accepting something out of trust, out of faith, it seems, is not faulty in itself. Okay, but let's see how the Buddha continues in his discussion. Okay, so then when this is said, then the Buddha replies to the Nikantas. He says, there are five things that may turn out in two different ways here and now. What are these five? They are faith, approval, or maybe liking, we could say, ruchi. It means like a personal liking for teaching. Oral tradition, what has been, because in the Buddha's time, teachings were passed down, spiritual teachings always passed down orally. And this referred especially to the Brahmins who passed down the Vedas orally. But the Buddha's text also came to be passed down orally, you know, from generation to generation, 300, 400 years till they were written down. So now we could say written scriptures. Okay, then reasoned cogitation or reflection. I think, Johnny, you said that. And then the fifth is reflective acceptance of a view. That is, one is exposed to a particular view and one reflects upon it. So actually, we could say that all of these five could be basis for a Buddhist to accept the idea of karma and rebirth. We have faith in the Buddha, and we believe that at least these texts are preserving the word of the Buddha. We have what's called approval here, but maybe I would prefer liking. You know, just somebody spontaneously develops a liking for Buddhism, and so then they find out what the Buddha's teaching is, and so because they like Buddhism, and so they'll accept what the Buddha says about karma, rebirth, defilements. Oral tradition, or now we can say a scriptural tradition. This is what it says in Majjhima Nikaya Sutta number 4, passages 27, something like that. Reason cogitation, or reflective reflection, reflection on reasons. I could reflect, why do people, some people have a lot of misery, illness, misfortune, trouble, difficulties. Other people, everything goes easy for them. They meet with success, whatever they do. The one who tries hard, he is always meeting with obstacles. The one who just sits back and, you know, watches the ball game and listens to music, goes outside and just strikes it rich. So why does this happen? Someone reflects, and then maybe one thinks, it must be due to deeds, their past actions when, in previous lives, and so on. Then reflective acceptance of a view. Again, one gets exposed to the view of Buddha Dharma, one reflects on it, and one can accept it. So the things the Buddha says here, these may turn out in two different ways here and now. He doesn't elaborate it here, probably in the actual situation he did, but a few suttas earlier, the two different ways things will turn out is explained, and so probably the compilers of the text didn't have to fill this out, because they would have realized that the reader or listener would know it from the previous sutta. So the way things turn out, two different ways things might turn out, is the Buddha says a person on page 780 in the Majjhima Nikaya, somebody might accept something fully out of faith, and the faith might turn out to be empty, hollow, and false. But again, somebody might accept something fully out of faith and it might be true and valid. Similarly, with each of the others, somebody might like something, it might be false, and somebody might like something and it might be true. And so with each of the other reasons. So the point is that these five reasons for accepting a teaching, for accepting a belief, are not sufficient to guarantee the truth of that belief. What they will do is dispose one to accept the belief, but in order to determine whether the belief is true or false, one needs a more secure basis, a more solid ground, which would be personal experiential confirmation. Okay, so now the Buddha continues, and he is somewhat hard on the chains, I have to say. He says, what kind of faith do you venerable Jains have in a teacher who speaks about the past? What kind of liking or approval? What kind of oral tradition? What kind of reasoned cogitation? What kind of reflective acceptance of a view? And speaking thus, I did not see any legitimate defense of their position by the Jains. Does it seem to be a somewhat too severe? What do you think? Okay, suppose we have some some Jains sitting in the audience, and I give a typical explanation of the 12 links of dependent origination. So I say, because of our ignorance and craving in the past, we engage in karmic activities. Those karmic activities bring about a renewal of the stream of consciousness at rebirth. When consciousness descends and gets a footing, it brings along name and form. From the development of name and form, there emerge the six sense bases. The six sense bases give rise to contact. Contact gives rise to feeling. Feeling gives rise to craving and clinging. Through our clinging, we generate a new existence in the future. Then comes new birth, then old age and death. So now, just when I feel very proud of myself for such an elegant explanation of the 12 links, some Jains come up and say, what is your basis for explaining in that way? I say, this is what I learned from the Buddhist texts. Then he says, well, what kind of faith do you have, Bhante, in the Buddhist texts? What kind of liking, what kind of reasoned reflection, what kind of reflective acceptance of a view? Speaking thus, I did not see any legitimate defense of his position by Bhikkhu Bodhi. Okay, so I have to say, it does seem a bit hard to me. Okay, so now the Buddha continues. Okay, now he's saying to the Jains, what do you think? When there is this intense exertion, this intense striving, and he's referring to the ascetic practices that the Jains undertake, do you then feel racking, piercing feelings due to your intense exertion, to your self-mortification? And when there is no intense exertion, no intense striving, then is it the case that you do not feel those painful, racking, piercing feelings? And so now the Jains admit that when we undertake this extreme austere practices, these austere self-mortification practices, then we feel painful, racking feelings. But when we aren't undertaking the extreme self-mortification practices, then we do not feel those painful, piercing feelings. And so here the Buddha has actually, I would say, succeeded in showing the Jains that their thesis that whatever a person feels, whether pain, pleasure, or neither painful nor pleasant feeling, all that is caused by what was done in the past. Because now he's shown them that they're experiencing painful feelings because of what they're doing in the present. And so with this, the Buddha has, in a sense, undermined their position that by annihilating with the asceticism past actions and by creating no fresh karma, there will be no consequence in the future, and so on. So now the Buddha sort of draws out the conclusion. He says, if when there was intense striving, you experience those painful feelings due to your striving. But when there was no intense exertion, no intense striving, you still experienced those extremely severe painful feelings. In that case, you might have some basis for claiming that whatever one feels is due to action performed in the past. But since you feel those extremely painful feelings only when you're engaged in the self-mortification. And when you stop the self-mortification, those painful feelings stop, then you cannot claim that everything that you feel is due to what was done in the past. And so then the Buddha says, it is through ignorance, unknowing, and delusion that you mistakenly hold whatever this person feels, whether pleasure, pain, or neutral feeling, all that was done, all that is felt because of what was done in the past. Okay, then the Buddha goes through a rather long interrogation of the Jains about the different ways of eliminating karma. I'm not going to go through that. You can read it on your own and follow the notes. But we just come to the conclusion that gets rather long and tedious, but I'll just maybe try to sum up the conclusion. I'll let you read the long conclusion on paragraph 21. But with paragraph 22, then the Buddha draws out what he takes to be 10 legitimate deductions from their own assertions, from what the Jains themselves have admitted, 10 deductions from their assertions that provide grounds for censoring them. First, one is that if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Jains must have done bad deeds in the past because now they are feeling such painful, racking, piercing feelings. Okay, so if they're subjecting themselves to such, you know, intense austerities, by practicing extremely long fasts, by taking up the squatting posture and holding it for days on end without lying down, exposing their bodies to the heat of the sun, to the cold of the night, lying down on beds of thorns, then they're experiencing extremely painful feelings. And so if all of these feelings were done by their karma from past lives, then they must have created bad karma in their past lives. Okay, so that is one conclusion. And that would be the conclusion that agrees with the Jain's own position, that whatever one experiences was done in the past. But now the Buddha says, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the activity of a supreme creator God, then the Nigantha surely must have been created by an evil God, since they now feel such painful, racking, piercing feelings. The Jains themselves were not theists. They didn't accept the idea of a God. This was more the position of the Brahmins. Okay, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by circumstance and nature, then the Jains surely must have bad luck, since they now feel such painful feelings. Okay, this was a position of another school contemporary with the Buddha. These were called the Ajivakas, who held that whatever beings experience, pleasure or pain, is caused by chance and circumstance. No other causal explanation. Okay, then the fourth is, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by their class, according to their birth, and what are called the six classes of birth. This was a position held by another contemporary teacher of the period. Then the Jains surely must belong to a bad class, since they now feel such painful feelings. Then if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Jains must be striving badly here and now, since they feel such painful, racking feelings. Okay, so those are the first five grounds for censoring the Jains. The next five, I have to say, I don't really understand so well. Okay, so it says that, number six, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Jains are to be censored. If it's not the case, then the Jains are still to be censored. In this case, they would be censored because they're advocating a wrong view. That would be the view that beings, whatever beings feel, are caused by what was done in the past. Okay, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme God, then the Nigantas are to be censored. If not, they are still to be censored. I don't know why they should be censored in that case. Anybody have any idea about that? Because that isn't the position of the Jains. Okay, it's not clear. Okay. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by chance, then the Nigantas, the Jains, are to be censored. If not, they are still to be censored. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by birth into a particular class among the six classes, then the Jains are to be censored. If not, they are still to be censored. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Jains are to be censored. If not, they are still to be censored. Here it would make sense, because then the Jains would be subjecting themselves to these austerities, and the austerities would be not have any purpose. They would be useless. Okay, so in this way, the Buddha comes to the conclusion that the exertion of the Jains is fruitless, their striving is fruitless. So we could say that the whole passage here, this whole extended criticism of the Jains, really, to, you know, simply draw out the conclusion from it very simply and succinctly, is that the kind of self-mortification to which the Jains subjected themselves is not fruitful, it's not beneficial, it's not conducive to the development of wholesome qualities, and it doesn't lead to enlightenment and liberation. And how can the Buddha say this so surely, so confidently? How can he say that?
Through his own experience?
Yeah. And what kind of experience?
Experiencing his Buddhahood.
Well, I had something more precise in mind. Through his own experience, what kind of experience?
Having gone beyond all this suffering?
Having gone beyond it, but gone before going beyond it, gone through it, because he himself undertook many of these practices in the period when he was seeking enlightenment. So he accepted, or at least he experimented with the old Indian belief that the way to liberation is through self-mortification. And he says that he carried those practices, you know, as far as they can go, almost to the point of the verge of death. But he found that it's not going to lead to enlightenment. And then he developed, or he found, another way to enlightenment, what he called the middle way, developed that, and then he reached enlightenment. And so in his own teaching, he doesn't advocate the practice of these extreme austerities, though as we'll see, that there is some type of austere practice that the Buddha permits. Okay, so now, with paragraph 23, we really start on where the Buddha is expounding his own approach. So now he brings up the question, how is the exertion fruitful? How is the striving fruitful? And so here he takes the case of a monk who is not overwhelmed with suffering and who does not overwhelm himself or oppress himself with suffering. And he does not give up that pleasure that accords with the Dharma, and yet he is not infatuated with that pleasure, or does not become attached to that pleasure. And so this is what the Buddha himself discovered after he experimented with the austerities, carrying them to the ultimate extreme. Then he relinquished them. And then he remembered an experience that he had when he was a child. One day when there was a plowing festival taking place, and his father was the ruler of the Shakyans at that time, so his father was the one to take the lead in the plowing the fields. And he brought the young boy, the young prince Siddhartha, brought him to the field and placed him under the tree. And while he sat there, the young boy, watching the plowing take place, just sort of spontaneously, he crossed his legs, started focusing on his breath, and zoom, he went right into the first jhana. And the first jhana, the meditative absorption, is accompanied by joy and pleasure or happiness. And so now, when he gave up on the ascetic practices, he recollected that experience in childhood, and then the question came to him, could this be the path to enlightenment? And first he was a little reluctant to accept that, because it was a pleasant experience, and sort of the belief of the time was that if there's a pleasant experience, you have to be wary of it. It could lead you astray. But now he realized that this happiness, this pleasant experience, is a wholesome experience because it's detached from defilements, It clears and purifies the mind, and it's a wholesome quality that can be used as a basis for development. And so with that, the Buddha continued to develop the jhanas, and he went through the four jhanas, and then on that basis, he reached enlightenment. And so the Buddha, then when he taught the path, often emphasized the jhanas, or even if one is not developing all of the jhanas, but he emphasized that the path should be a pleasant path, that it's through pleasure that one can attain the ultimate pleasure. And so at least one of the approaches that the Buddha has taught amongst the different approaches to enlightenment, so the approaches or means of self-cultivation, is called Sukha Patipatta, which means pleasant practice. Okay, so this is Sukha Patipatta. It's one of the modes of practice, which is the practice which utilizes pleasure in order to advance along the path. And so the Buddha distinguishes between wholesome pleasure and unwholesome pleasure. Unwholesome pleasure is the pleasure that arises from indulgence of sensual desire or sensual craving. So when one indulges sensual craving, that causes greed and clinging and attachment to arise, and then the mind becomes soiled and bound to these sensual pleasures. But the other kind of pleasant feeling is the pleasant feeling that arises in states of mind that are detached from sensual desires. And so as one draws away from sensual craving, when the mind becomes more focused, collected, then there arises piti, which is joy, and sukha, which is happiness or pleasure. And by pursuing the wholesome types of happiness, one can discard the unwholesome types of happiness. By cultivating the wholesome types of pleasure, one can discard and renounce the unwholesome types of pleasure. And so, you know, somebody might find pleasure from going to the bar and drinking with friends and listening to rock concerts and dancing wildly and so on, and that's his lifestyle. But, you know, if we say to that person, you give that up and you live in a monastery, you eat one meal a day, then they can't do it so easily. But if one tells the person, okay, you can live your ordinary lifestyle, but at least take out, you know, a half an hour a day, a half an hour morning and evening, devote yourself to meditation, or do some good practices, then they'll undertake that practice. And little by little, they'll start to get experiences of, you know, calm and quiet mind. Maybe some piti, some joy will arise. some special kind of feeling of pleasure and peacefulness. And then when they think, when their friends call them and say, come, let's go to the bar on Saturday night. There's a, you know, we could drink and then we can go to a rock concert. Then they think, I don't want that anymore. Because they realize that that's, you know, disturbing and distressing to the mind. Okay, so here the Buddha is using the case of a monk who doesn't overwhelm himself with suffering and doesn't give up that pleasure that accords with the Dharma. And so he knows, when I strive with determination, this particular source of suffering fades away in me because of that determined striving. And when I look on with equanimity, this particular source of suffering fades away in me while I develop equanimity. So these are two approaches, one could say, within this pleasant practice to overcoming defilements. I think what is meant by the source of suffering would be the defilements of mind. So one way is vigorously trying to eliminate those defilements. So we could say within the pleasant practice, there is a forceful approach, and we might call this the gentle or equanimity approach. So with the forceful approach, one sometimes has to use virya, energy, vigor, effort to push away the defilement that arises. One could do it either by turning the mind to some other meditation subject that's directly opposed to that defilement, or just arousing one's energy and striving vigorously. The sound? Where is that sound coming? From the fan. Okay, so one approach is to use like forceful effort to push the defilement away. The other approach, what I call the gentle approach, is just to sort of turn the mind back upon itself and watch those defiled thoughts, those unwholesome thoughts, watch them from a position of detached equanimity. Okay, and then as, continuing with the text, when he strives with determination in regard to that particular source of suffering which fades away in him because of that determined striving. So when he uses force or vigor to overcome that defilement, then that defilement will fade away in him. And in case of the other, sometimes he looks on with equanimity, and just by looking on with equanimity, that defilement and the defiled thoughts will fade away as he watches with equanimity. And so the Buddha says, in each case, that suffering is exhausted in him. And then the Buddha illustrates this with a simile. And when I read the simile, I think, wow, the Buddha has such an understanding of human psychology that he must have experienced this himself to come up with the simile. Okay, suppose a man loves a woman with his mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. Then he might see that woman standing with another man chatting, joking, and laughing, what do you think? Wouldn't sorrow, grief, and despair arise in that man when he sees that woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing? And then the monks say, yes. Why is that? Because he loves that woman so much, with such intense desire and passion. I like to ask, is there anybody who hasn't experienced this before? If there isn't, would you raise your hand? A man towards a woman, or woman towards a man, or anybody towards anybody else? Okay. So here the man is bound to the woman so that he's always, you know, worried, suspicious, whenever he sees her talking to another man, if they're smiling or laughing, he's wondering, oh, so something is going on between them, and he's feeling so jealous and envious, and then he goes home and he's feeling so miserable, and maybe he's even plotting to kill the woman. Well, actually, this is how the murders take place, murders due to love. Maybe he's plotting to kill the woman or to kill the other man, his rival. So miserable because of that. But now he's getting a little intelligent, so he he reflects. I love this woman with my mind bound to her by intense desire and passion. And so whenever I see her speaking to another man, joking with him, I feel so miserable. So what's the solution? I don't want to go out and, you know, to kill a woman, kill a man. I just can't continue on in this state of misery. So what if I abandon my desire and lust for that woman? And so he overcomes his desire and lust. And then on a later occasion, he sees a woman standing with another man, chatting, joking, and laughing. And what do you think? Is pain and misery and suffering going to arise in him? And the answer is no. And why is that? Because the man no longer has that intense attachment to her. How does that simile apply in the case of the monk who is striving to overcome the defilements? How would we apply it? Just think a little bit and take a guess. How about one of our visitors? Please. But we have another microphone. Anybody else have any ideas?
I think that maybe...
Wait, take the microphone.
I think that maybe the striving is the woman. So when you become attached and have intense desire for the striving, it causes the grief, sorrow, and suffering. And then when you detach from the striving... When you have the intense desire for the striving and something, progress doesn't arise, then you feel sorrow, grief. But when you're not such attached to the striving, then progress comes, or it doesn't come, then you'll feel so pain stricken.
But that's an interesting way to think of it. Anybody else have any ideas? And I want to say that I don't have a fixed answer in my mind that I'm waiting for somebody to say. But I just want to see what kind of interpretations one could put on the relation between the simile and the case to which it applies. Sandy, you have some idea.
I think it's because we have attachment to something or someone. I think the jealousy is because we have attachment to that person.
Well, that applies in the simile. But now, how does the simile apply to the case of a monk who's striving, sometimes vigorously, sometimes with equanimity? Please.
I think maybe with the monk striving so
Excuse me?
With the monk striving to achieve something, when he gave that up and just let it happen, things happen naturally. So I think with the man loving the woman, he tried so hard to show her love by bowing to her and by doing all these things, and then when he's seen her getting joy from another man and wanting to speak to another person, it brought him sorrow.
Yeah.
But when he gave that up, that attachment, and just accepted it for what it was, he's seen her happy. It made him happy because
Okay, that's good also. I think your explanation is very similar to the Venerable Kanti, Sagara Kanti. Okay, we'll go on now. Okay, so this passage is explaining what we call the Sukhapatipatta, the pleasant practice, which can be either, as I said, forceful, or it can be the gentle, equanimous mode of practice. But now, paragraph 27 introduces what is called elsewhere in the text dukkha-patipatta, and this is painful practice or difficult practice. And here the text says, here the monk is considering thus, while I live according to my pleasure, unwholesome states increase in me and wholesome states diminish. But when I exert myself in what is painful, unwholesome states diminish in me and wholesome states increase. What if I exert myself in what is painful? He exerts himself in what is painful. When he does so, unwholesome states diminish in him, and wholesome states increase. At a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. And why is that? The purpose for which that monk exerted himself in what is painful has been achieved. That is why, at a later time, he does not exert himself in what is painful. Okay, so we see from this that even though the Buddha teaches a pleasant path, a path that's intended to produce higher states of joy and pleasure, but he doesn't completely reject the use of what is called painful practice. And what is meant by painful practice here? It's not the kind of self-mortification practices to which the Jains and some of the other ascetic groups subjected themselves. But generally it refers to undertaking certain practices which are called, in Pali they're called dutanga, which means literally factors for shaking off defilement. Yeah, so these are practices like, for example, in the Buddha's time, well, even today some monks do this, they will, instead of using robes which are already made commercially and sold in shops, they'll collect pieces of cast-off cloth and sew them together and make their own robe and then dye them, and they'll wear those, they call them rag robes. Or it can be the practice of eating only one meal a day, collected on alms round, going from door to door to eat food collected on alms round, not to accept food which is brought to the monastery or the temple, not to accept invitations to houses for meals, but always going door to door. And regarding sleeping, there are different practices like sleeping out in the forest, living under at the foot of a tree, not living with the roof under one's head, except during the 3 months of the rainy season. Probably the most demanding practice is what's called the sitting practice, which means that one sleeps in the sitting position, not lying down to sleep. So those are some of the austere practices that the Buddha allowed. And when one undertakes those practices, they're for the practice of overcoming the craving for, maybe for nice, colorful robes, well-tailored robes, or for good, delicious, well-prepared food, for a comfortable living place. And so one accommodates the mind, or one trains the mind to accommodate itself to difficult conditions. So practicing in this way, one learns to develop equanimity towards difficult conditions as well as easy or congenial conditions. Okay, and apart from the Dutanga practices, there's also an approach to meditation which belongs to the Dukkhapatipada, the difficult practice, difficult mode of practice. And that is to take up certain meditation subjects which are not so appealing to the mind, which have a kind of gritty impact on the mind. Like usually one likes to practice a meditation, type of meditation, which is comfortable to the mind, congenial, easygoing on the mind. For example, mindfulness of breathing is very calming. Or one can meditate on the figure of the Buddha, recollection of the Buddha. One has the Buddha image, which is very beautiful and inspiring. Or the meditation on loving kindness, sending metta, loving kindness, to beings in all the directions. So that has, all of these meditation subjects naturally generate joy and happiness and tranquility. But there are other meditation approaches to meditation which sort of cut against the grain of the mind. They have a kind of abrasive impact on the mind. But these meditation subjects can help to counteract certain defilements or unwholesome tendencies. For example, the meditation on death, the recollection of death. You know, it's like one of the thoughts that we don't like to entertain is the idea that I will die. I think it was Woody Allen who says this in one of his movies. He says, "I'm not afraid of death. I just don't want to be around when it happens." But in this meditation, one actually takes the fact of one's death and brings it right to the forefront of the mind, so that one reflects on the fact that death is inevitable, the time of its arrival is completely uncertain, And when I die, I have to give up everything. Another meditation that belongs to the difficult practice is the meditation on the parts of the body, examining the body in terms of its different tissues, organs, and fluids. So when one meditates in this way, it's offered as the antidote to sensual craving. Okay, and then the meditation on impermanence also can fall into the difficult practice, because one has to contemplate everything that arises as passing away. Okay, so the monk who's described here can make use of these practices in order to help to overcome unwholesome states, to make unwholesome states or mental qualities diminish and wholesome states increase. But he doesn't pursue this practice as an end in itself. And so when he achieves his purpose with these painful or difficult practices, then he no longer exerts himself in them, because those practices have fulfilled their purpose. And so now the Buddha illustrates this with the example of an arrowsmith who's warming and heating an arrow shaft between two flames to make it straight and workable. Okay, so then when the shaft has been warmed and heated between the two flames and it's become straight and workable, then the arrowsmith wouldn't heat up the arrow shaft again. There's no need to put it in the flame again, because now the purpose has been achieved and the shaft is straight and workable. And so this applies to the way the monk undertaking these painful or difficult practices, that's like the arrowsmith heating up the arrow in order to straighten it out. Okay, so the Buddha says, thus too the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Okay, and then the Buddha now is going to illustrate another way in which the practice is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. And here he goes into the whole graduated sequence that we meet again and again in the middle-length discourses of the sequential training, starting with the arising of a Tathagata or Buddha in the world, his teaching of the Dharma, the monk or the person hears the teaching, gains faith, goes forth into homelessness, undertakes the training in sila or virtuous behavior, then undertakes the training in restraint of the senses, mindfulness, and clear comprehension. He goes off into solitude, abandons the five hindrances. Then with the abandoning of the five hindrances, he attains the four, in order, the four jhanas. Then with his mind purified and concentrated through the jhanas, he recollects his own past lives in their particulars and details. Again, with the concentrated mind, he recollects, or he develops the divine eye through which he can see the passing away and rebirth of beings, and understands how beings pass away and take rebirth in accordance with their karma. And then third, with the concentrated mind, he directs his faculty of knowledge to the Four Noble Truths, and he penetrates, as it really is, the truth of suffering, the truth of its origin, the truth of its cessation, and the way leading to the cessation of suffering. And with that, he reaches the destruction of the asavas, the defilements, and he understands that the round of rebirths is destroyed, the holy life has been lived, What had to be done has been done. There is no more coming back to any state of being. So in this way, too, the exertion is fruitful, the striving is fruitful. Okay, so in that is what the Buddha says. And okay, any questions or comments on what's been covered so far? Okay, so now we've just come to the very conclusion of the sutta. This seems to me a little questionable that the Buddha himself spoke this, because it sounds a little bit like boasting. But he says, because the Tathagata speaks thus, there are 10 legitimate grounds for praising him. Okay. And he's taking those five positions that he took with regard to the Jains. He says, if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by what was done in the past, then the Tathagata, the Buddha, surely must have done good deeds in the past, since he now feels or experiences such taintless, pleasant feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by the creative act of a supreme god, then the Buddha must surely have been created by a good creator god, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. If the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by chance and circumstance, then the Buddha surely has good luck, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. And if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by rebirth into a particular class, then the Buddha surely must belong to a good class, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. And if the pleasure and pain that beings feel are caused by exertion here and now, then the Buddha surely must strive well here and now, since he now feels such taintless, pleasant feelings. And then 6 to 10, the Buddha says that in each of these cases, if it's true, the Tathagata is to be praised, and even if it's not true, the Tathagata is to be praised. And so there are these 10 legitimate grounds for praising him. Okay, that is the end of the sutta. Do you think the Buddha himself spoke that, or does it seem like it would have been added by the compilers of the canon? What do you think, Subodha? Doesn't it seem a bit like boasting? Actually, there are quite a few that sound like boasting, but...
So what makes this stand out as different than other instances?
Maybe because there are 10 grounds. But also one could say that it's not really boasting, but he's just stating the true circumstance of the situation of a Tathagata, since he's completely free from any sense of self. So he's not doing this to exalt himself, but just stating plain fact. That would be a counter-argument. That's a good point.
Maybe to these people, maybe it can be boasted, and maybe they feel, oh, I'm going to be well accomplished and have these 10 grounds to stand on as well.
Okay, that's a good point, that the Buddha knows the right occasion to speak to the appropriate audience, or he knows what is appropriate to speak according to the occasion, according to the audience. And so he spoke in this way because he's addressing the monks in order to sort of strengthen or reinforce their confidence and to inspire them to strive on more diligently. A good point. Way in the back. Yeah, there is a mobile microphone, if you take that.
It seems we have this all the time from the Buddha's birth when he said, I alone am the honored one. And people immediately say, what is he talking about?
Yeah.
And not understanding that he's speaking already from a place of no separation, of no dualism.
From this place.
The whole universe as being present, and it's not the self speaking. So I think we have this kind of easy misinterpretation.
Yeah.
Is what could sound selfish or
yeah.
From the very beginning.
And what's interesting, when the Buddha is speaking in ways that sound boastful, usually he doesn't say, I am such and such, but usually it's saying, he refers to himself almost in the third person, the Tathagata. So it's almost like he's standing outside of himself, like saying the teacher, you know, the exalted teacher has such and such qualities. Does anybody else have anything to add about this? Please, yeah.
So the leap frog off that is the idea of the exaltation and where it's directed to the feedback loop, sort of. And figure out the best way to phrase this, the existence of karmic conditions that allow for Buddhahood and Tathagata to exist seems like the exaltation is being placed on that versus a personal self.
Oh yeah, that's the point, yeah. Please. Yeah, this gentleman with shaved head.
Could it be the case that the use of the in front of Tathagata instead of I, could that be a useful recitation device for oral transmission? Is there any chance that that's the reason why that's used?
You mean that when the Buddha is referring to himself as the Tathagata, that this is the way the compilers of
this syllables be more rhythmic or easier to memorize, perhaps?
That I don't know, because we don't really have a way to check on that.
Yeah.
But I would think that the Buddha, it seems to me quite possible that the Buddha would have referred to himself in the Tathagata as a way, to himself as the Tathagata as a way of sort of taking a third person stance on himself, you know, to sort of step out of the language of I and mine and to make objective claims about himself, because in order to, I guess, to win the trust and confidence of the people that he's addressing, he has in fact to show his own status as an enlightened one. Like if one recalls the occasion after the Buddha's enlightenment described in Sutta 26 in the Majjhima Nikaya, when he first approaches his former friends, the five ascetics, who have, you know, abandoned him because he started to consume food again. Then after he achieves enlightenment, when he comes to them to start teaching, he says, he doesn't say, I am, let me just see how he puts it. Yeah, when he comes to them, he says, the Tathagata is an accomplished one, a fully enlightened one, Listen, O monks, the deathless has been attained. So here he's addressing himself as the Tathagata, and he doesn't come on and say, I have become a fully enlightened one, but he says the Tathagata is a fully enlightened one. The deathless has been attained. It's a third person statement. But then he says, I shall instruct you, I shall teach you the Dhamma, and if you practice as instructed, you yourselves will realize the supreme goal of the spiritual life. Okay, it's 11:20, so at this point we will end for the morning. And then we go for lunch now. And then after lunch we come back and we could have a little discussion period. If you'd like to come back, you can. About 12 o'clock we'll come back. 12:10, make it 12:10. Okay, so we end with the sharing of the merits. I think sheets were given out. These are verses in Pali for sharing the merits. So we share the merits with the devas or deities, the nagas or dragon spirits, the bhutas or fear spirits, wishing them to rejoice in the merits and then to protect the Dhamma, to protect the world, to protect all beings. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodiva chiram rakantu sasanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodiva chiram rakantu desanam. Akasata jabumata deva naga mahitika punyantam anumodita chiram rakantu mam param. Etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe devanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavatacham hei sampadam punya sampadam sabbe sadanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Bhavagopadaya vichitato etantare satakayupapanna rupiya rupicha sanya sanino tukha pamuchantu pusantu nibhutin. Okay, we end with three half bows to the Buddha.
Bhavupandam.